everybody. Welcome to a French Village podcast. I'm here with my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes. We are talking about season finale, episodes 11 and 12 of season 4. Ben, hi.
Hey, Sarah. I had homework this week, and I did it.
Oh, did I give you homework? What was my
homework? Well, we kind of had a little memory dispute about how much responsibility Danielle Larcher has for the baby stealing episode. And so I went back and watched the relevant scenes from season one. And I have the answer to our question.
Does the t-shirt hold up? Is Sarah always right? Or do we need a Ben's always right t-shirt?
It's a little bit in between, actually.
Yeah.
Danielle has more responsibility than I remember, but less than his brother accuses him of, and less than the Spanish Republican fellow thinks, and less than you remember. So here is what happened. If we can get a cool flashback to season one noise, some kind of cool noise here, that would be awesome. So what happens is the father of Takiero shows up one morning at Danielle and Hortense's house, catches Danielle completely by surprise, and Danielle lies to him by way of putting him off and getting rid of him. Tells him he wasn't in town that day and didn't deliver the baby, and there was no obstetrician in Villeneuve that day, and the guy goes away. He then goes to the police station and makes a report of a missing baby to Mercati, who comes back to the house and basically says, hey, it'd be just your word against his, and we can resolve it that way. And Danielle, this is now same day as the guy shows up after this conversation with Danielle, with Mercati, says to Hortense, we have to give the baby back. There's only one right thing to do. And they have quite an argument about it. So Danielle is definitely, he does lie to the guy, but within, 4 hours of the lie is ready to give the baby back, at which point Marketi and Hortense, without Danielle's knowledge, hatch this plot to have this guy arrested and sent to a concentration camp. And Danielle is not a party to that. And so I think you can say he bears some responsibility in that he is definitely lies to the guy, and you can totally understand why the guy thinks he's in on it. But he's actually, by the middle of the day, he's all ready to give the baby back, and it's not him who has the guy arrested in order to keep the baby.
Yeah. And I think, so I don't know if you went any further episodes ahead, but like, then there's the part where he discovers it, right? At some point that they've done this thing. And I guess this is actually sort of quintessential Daniel culpability, like his range, which is his moral instincts are basically always correct. Right. Like he doesn't want to steal the baby. He doesn't really have the conscience for that. Certainly doesn't want this guy, what Hortense and Marchetti do is just like pure evil, because not only are they taking the baby, they're trying to like get rid of the father so he never comes back. But I do think like Danielle, then there's like seasons of him back with Hortense, and like he does discover it all, right? He like knows what's going on. It's not like he goes to the police or anything else. And so I think if we were judging him in a contemporary context and we heard this story, and like he did nothing about it while this guy's like in jail or in a concentration camp, like we would judge him slightly differently than we do on the show, because he's consistently making, decisions that we can understand, agree with, and does a lot of good all the time. He's always doing good and trying to do good. But anyway, all of this is to say that feels about right, which is just, you know, I just don't let him off the hook completely for the tech hero stuff.
Yeah, so I agree with you. He is not blameless. On the other hand, when he is in that cell with his brother and his brother accuses him of, says, hey, I talked to the Spanish Republican who was shot yesterday, and he says that you stole his baby and had him sent to a concentration camp with a corrupt cop. I do think Danielle would have legitimately got to protest, wait a minute, you know.
That was Hortense.
That was Hortense, Lady Macbeth over here. I may have lied to the guy, but I had nothing to do with sending him to a concentration camp.
Fair, yeah. Well, speaking of the cell, I think that, look, this is, I think as far as, these last two episodes of season four are extremely interesting. They're somehow managed to be both filled with action, and yet not feeling action-packed the way the last couple of episodes did. Like, they sort of, they unfurl kind of slowly.
Although they have some of the best scenes in the entire show. The scene with Shasanya and Marcel hanging out, waiting to get shot together, and developing a strange love-hate relationship is a truly wonderful piece of filmmaking.
So it is. So this is what, this is why throughout the season, you know, it's hard sometimes for me not to get ahead of myself, but like the parade of people that come through Marcel's cell is like a tremendous, like, it's just like plot, like it's like main character after main character sort of shows up. But I will say, I do want to start with, I want to know how you feel, and it's not really a spoiler. Hopefully everybody's watched this, but like, how you had said at one point that one thing you were deeply confident of is that both brothers Larchet make it through, that they're sort of the moral center of the show. And I will tell you, up until these episodes, when I watched it the first time, I certainly thought had a kind of like main character bias toward Marcel, and figured, but they're, you know, end of not even the end, in the middle of the finale, he and Chasan, yeah, are executed together at dawn by Mueller and his firing squad. And so what did you make of, just overall, what do you make of the fact that Marcel, you know, season four, we've got three seasons to go, is out of the picture?
Well, so first of all, I think that it's courageous of the show, not in a Game of Thrones kind of, let's take glee in killing off our main characters with sudden brutality. But, you know, let's be honest, the odds of surviving the war as a resistance figure were not all that great. And the cheap thing for a show to do is to focus only on the people who do survive, you know, main character bias and all that. And the more honest thing to do is to straightforwardly kill some of them off. And I did not think that was what was going to happen with Marcel and Danielle. And I admire the show for actually staring it in the face and you know, being willing to say, hey, you know, two brothers who you might get attached to, who were strangely, given their actual relationship, quite attached to one another. You know, we're not going to tell you which one doesn't survive, but one of them doesn't end up surviving, and it's going to come as a bit of a shock when it happens. And, you know, of course, it shouldn't be a shock. He's, after all, under death sentence in a cell being held by the Gestapo. He's not, you know, he's not like done well for himself in life. No, I was still surprised when it happened. And I was actually surprised that they went through with it and killed off Shasanya too. So I thought it was a bit of a, like, when you actually realize that they're going to shoot him, which is that moment when they show them walking down the hall. It's pretty, I found it pretty surprising.
Yeah. And because the show is, you know, trying, like Suzanne is sort of valiantly trying to get Lario to come up with some kind of a plan. And so I guess until the end, you're sort of like, does something happen here? Does the resistance show up? But yeah, you're pretty sure when they're walking that it's done. And in fact, I would say when they started sharing the Turkish cigarettes in the cell, I feel like that's when I knew they were done. Like, and your point about this great scene. So Chisanya ends up there. You know, the episodes open with Chisanya doing sort of a tough guy interrogation thing of the townspeople trying to find Antoine. Of course, these are all the people who had him on the ground, were beating him up, and now he's got the upper hand, and they're all kind of cowering in front of him, and he's got a knife to a guy's neck. Marchetti kind of shuts it down, saying this is actually a bad way to interrogate people because you got to find people who actually know the answers to these things. None of these guys seem to actually know where Antoine is. But everybody agrees that the fact that they held this parade is deeply humiliating for both the French sort of Vichy government and the Germans. And so all they need is Antoine's head on it. Like, their careers all depend on it. People not being sent back to Russia depend on it. And so the hunt for Antoine becomes sort of the centerpiece of all of this, as well as just sort of an extensive blame game, right? There's a lot of finger pointing, maybe not unlike what we're seeing right now with Afghanistan. Everybody's looking for who to blame for something and trying to, well, I don't know that they're the same, but finger pointing's on my mind this morning. And so there's a lot of finger pointing going on. Mueller doing his best to track down both Antoine and a narrative that exonerates him from this being his fault. And they basically decide Chisanya is going to be the fall guy. And much like a bowl of mashed potatoes in the face, Mueller basically says, you know what? He was the mayor of the town. That means he's the chief of police. That means this is his fault. He sort of narrows down the fact that the calls were coming from the police HQ, and that means Chisanya is responsible. And he quickly throws him in a cell. And I'm not sure that getting Chisanya's death sentence off with doesn't sort of speed up Marcel's. Like, they decide to do it together. But anyway, that's how they find themselves in this cell together. And Marcel's clearly been in there a long time. His best friend is this cockroach. He's named him. He's given him a home. But the scenes where Chisanya kind of walks in and they, you know, they start talking. They know exactly who each other are. They know each other's political ideologies. And it's sort of a little similar to his conversation with Daniel, where, like, he's sort of grateful for the company, but he also wants to make sure that he calls Chisanya a fascist. And when Chisanya is kind of doing this, like, hey, man, what do you think happens to us after we die? Marcel is quick to say, I don't know. What do you think happened to all of those people you deported when they died? And, you know, he keeps, despite the weird kinship they do as two men who have decided they're going to die together, he also accuses him up until the end of the things that he did.
And Chisanya rightly throws it back in his face. Of course, these are not Marcel's personal crimes, but says, you know, dude, have you heard of the Moscow trials? The Great Purge? And, you know, Marcel's, calls Marcel on his political blindness to the murderous violence of his own particular form of totalitarianism. And, you know, not a lot of people in the show actually do that with Marcel. But, you know, Chisanya, you know, horrible, murderous fascist though he is, actually calls him on it and says, you know, we're both murderous, you know, willing to, you know, part of murderous authoritarian, totalitarian movements. I just admit it. And you don't, and you think you have the moral high ground. And And I actually think that's kind of the moment where Marcel kind of develops a weird kind of respect for him. It's not, you know, they're both there in the same cell. They're both going to be shot because of their political activities on behalf of horrible movements. They both believe in those movements. You know, Shesanya actually barks at him at one point, collaboration is the only solution, you know, like he like really believes his own, like smoked a bit too much of his own load, but so has Marcel. And, you know, Marcel has looked Stalin in the face and seen Jesus. And, you know, that's a special kind of delusion too. And of course they're both, but at the end of the day, never the twain shall meet between their politics. They both would shoot the other one if they had the chance, and yet they're going to get shot together. And there's a certain camaraderie in that. And they develop this very weird kind of quasi-affectionate relationship that isn't wholly different from Marcel's relationship with Danielle.
Yeah, and the absolute best part of this whole of this scene is at some point a priest comes in to read them, ostensibly to read them their last rites or something, pray with them, and they both sort of simultaneously refuse the priest because as they both make clear, their higher power is politics to both of them. The things that they worship are kind of ideologies, and they're neither of them are much for the church or the higher power of the church. And so they both send the priest away, and then they both start laughing hysterically. And it occurs to me when I see this that you basically don't see Marcel smile like ever, let alone laugh. He's such a sort of grim character, occasionally with Suzanne, or occasionally you get like this half smirk with Gustav or something, but like he doesn't smile. He certainly doesn't laugh. And when he laughs, this like big laugh, he and Shesanya, I just like, first of all, he's like so handsome when he smiles, even all bloodied up, but it's some kind of moment.
They found the thing that these two great movements have in common other than murder was atheism.
Yeah.
And, you know, they are the two great political avowedly atheistic political movements of the 20th century. And both of them in different ways waged war on the church. The Nazis in a very particular, weird sort of way that it's probably a rabbit hole we don't want to go down. But it is also the case, and this is, it's been 20 plus years since I've read it, but in Eichmann in Jerusalem, Hannah Arendt describes, I believe, and again, please forgive me if I get this wrong because it's been a long time, but she describes Eichmann's last moment rejecting his last words. He basically says, you know, I'm a Nazi. I don't believe in the church. I don't believe in an afterlife. And it's, you know, a very pointedly atheistic last moment. And, you know, Hitler himself at one point said, you kind of either believe in the Führer or you believe in the church. And so these were like, it is quite right that both of them would have, and of course the Marxist tradition is fanatically atheistic. And so it's quite right that you'd have these two in a prison cell and they'd be arguing about whose murders are real and whose are fictions and whose are justified. But the thing they could really agree on is that, first of all, some mass murders are necessary for history. And secondly, the priest can go to hell.
Exactly. So the last sort of piece of this is that before he's executed, Marcel gives Mueller a note for Gustav, which, and I'll just say on this theme of sort of the strange respect that people have for one another, even though they want to kill each other for just like being devotees of their political ideology. Like Mueller has said this about Marcel too, that he respects his father, or he says it to Gustav, that he respects his father fighting for his, you know, political ideology. So as a gesture of respect, he does deliver the note to Gustav. The note says, I love you, be a man. Which that is either, depending on your interpretation, a very straightforward message or quite cryptic one. Because I'm not sure Gustav quite knows what be a man means, nor do I actually in this context.
I thought it was not. I mean, look, I liked the first half of the note, the second half, what does that mean to a 12-year-old or a 51-year-old? I thought the relevant sequence of events, I think, here starts in the previous episode, right, where Gustav has two opportunities to kill Mueller, one with a gun himself, and the second in the square when he could denounce him during the parade. And he doesn't do it. And then Mueller turns around and kills his father, having told him that he has a lot of respect for him. And then Mueller walks in with a note. You know, your father gave me this when I killed him. Subtext, because you missed your chance and didn't shoot me when you had the chance. And then you had a second chance and you didn't call me out to the parade. So yeah, I have a lot of respect for him, but it sure didn't stop me from putting his ass in front of a firing squad. Here you go. Here's his note. And Gustav, who's got one of these very inscrutable, blank, traumatized faces, which is simultaneously super expressive and super non-expressive, I don't think I have any sense how he's processed this. We know he doesn't want comfort from his Aunt Hortense. We know he doesn't say anything to Mueller. But we don't know whether his reaction to this is sort of like, oh, well, good, at least he respects my father and delivered his note, or whether his reaction is, I didn't pull that trigger when I had the chance, and I'm not going to miss another chance, which is, I think, kind of what the show is setting up. But definitely going to be looking in season 5 for Gustav's revenge. It'll be as a 13-year-old, which is a little early in life to start a hunt for revenge. But I definitely think the finale episode set up the question of what's Gustav's longer term reaction going to be to this, especially because Mueller's effectively living in his house now.
Yeah. And then there's one other that's a good piece of foreshadowing. But there's one other sort of key thing that happens on the Chassagne front that I just want to note, which is that Janine comes to see him and is, you know, wants to get him out and, you know, doesn't understand why he's there. And Chassagne, for whatever reason, I mean, I guess just given her the full picture, wants to make it clear that this is a personal retribution from Mueller, I sort of forgot, or didn't have front of mind until he said it. He makes it sound like he slept with Hortense Larcher as kind of an affair, where we know he did it to.
It was a little more of an extortion-y.
A little more of an extortion-y
rapey kind of thing, rather exactly. than a fairy rapey kind of thing.
Exactly. And we don't quite know how much Mueller knows about that part of it, because that part's never expressed to Mueller that we see. But he's right that is part of Mueller just hates this guy. And that was even he already hated him. And then his wife having to go to him to help him is like even a bigger insult. So yeah, Mueller's
calculation is really lizard here. It's
yeah.
This guy has his claws in me. I have an opportunity to make my Antoine problem diminish by removing the claws and stomping on his neck. I'm going to take that. I actually don't think Hortense has sex with Hortense is really top of mind for him right now.
Yeah. Well, and what's great about this scene is Janine hears this and basically just walks out on him. Like, and I would say that that is maybe the nature of transactional relationships such as theirs, that they are not of the deepest level. Not that she should take this information and, you know, be glad about it, but there is, he is about to be executed. So to the extent that she had real affection for him, one might think that she would, you know, I don't still want to see him off in the right way. But instead she's like, no one's coming to help you and I'm out.
Yeah. I think there's also a connection here between this episode and the last episode where, you know, Janine, who is, I don't know, the fourth worst person in the show, after Mueller, Shasanya,
Hortense.
And Hortense, maybe fifth, I don't know, depending on how you, but she's like, she's really bad and she is totally cold.
Yeah.
And she, in the previous episode, starts looking at Shasanya as a bit of a liability. That is, unlike him, she is able to see to the end of the war. And she thinks she's might at risk, quite rightly, thinks she's at risk of being strung up. And then she sees him get beaten up at the parade. She knows, you know, she goes behind his back to pay basically blood money to the resistance to and I think part of her is looking forward and saying, you know, a year and a half from now or whenever liberation's going to be, am I better off with this guy or without him? And the only thing that holds her back is that she is, in a bad people sex kind of way, attracted to him and, you know, pretty into him. And, you know, his, you know, she's quite the fascist too, actually. And so then he cheats on her and it removes that aspect of affection to the extent that she's capable of feeling affection. And so what's left? Why save his life? It's only going to endanger. It's not clear you can do it, but you put yourself out there to save him. And then, you know, you're the woman who tried to save the fascist after, you know, after marrying the mayor, like you're worse off with him than without him. And by the way, the money's hers, you know? Yeah. And so, and she's got enough problems because of her dad's being some kind of Vichy muckety muck. And so I think she's just kind of like, you know, cut bait with this guy, which is, of course, exactly what's, you know, what everybody's starting to do. Servier doesn't lift a hand to help him. And in fact, Servier kind of lets the, helps the resistance escape in a way that we'll talk about later. Like, everybody's now suddenly playing both sides. And her way of playing both sides is, you know, fuck you. I'm going to put myself out for you when you're a liability, when the Allies show up and you're sleeping with Hortense. Give me a break. Get shot.
Yeah. So, and this is Servier's wife has now, because she's also the one who kind of broke it to Janine in the first place.
That is one smart lady.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, this woman who steals all of Servier's fries, and she deserves those fries because she's the only one who can. They are so locked up in their bureaucratic prism. Like, this is one of those kind of Trump comparisons you can make when, like, you're in an administration and you're like, but I'm here doing this. I'm making it better. Or I'm
Mercedes Schlapp.
Well, no, because Mercedes Schlapp never did the right thing and said, like, you got to get out of here. Like, Matt Schlapp doubled down left and right on this stuff.
I guess that's right. I just meant just in terms of bloodlessly playing the angles. But yeah, you're right. That they were more true believers. They were more Shasan than Servier.
Yeah, and I think that just Servier's wife, whatever she's plugged into, she like knows. She understands like that they've all got to stop. You know, they've got to shift what they're doing, and so she just must be hearing like through gossip or whatever. She's the one who's like, look, everybody, all the business people are paying, and so Servier then decides rather than the French arresting Antoine, and we got to go back and talk about how this sort of happens. But your point about Servier, he just lets Chassagne go, but also he realizes what that shows is that even the most fervent collaborators were on the menu, and that what occurs to him is that his collaboration is not an alibi anymore. It doesn't save him.
Well, and they see that so remember, there's no public opinion polling.
Right.
In fact, I learned from something I was reading last night that de Gaulle's form of public opinion polling was early, and this would have been earlier in the war, was to order things to happen and then see if they did, involving the mass public. So he would order, don't go out on such and such a day, stay inside, or be on the streets on such and such a day. And then you would see level of street activity, and you could see how many people were responding to de Gaulle's orders or requests. That was the level of public opinion that they had, that people really had access to. So if you're a Vichy official prior to probably summer of 42, you could really kid yourself that the public supported Vichy, as a lot of it did. And, you know, there wasn't really an organized resistance. There were kind of scattered groups doing scattered things, mostly like leafleting. But there wasn't there was no way to test, hey, where is the public? But now you have people marching through the streets, and you have, and you interrogate 100 people, and none of them will tell you who was there or where they are, right? People won't give them up. And they actually have these pretty granular ways of saying, hey, the public isn't with us. And there's actually a pretty frank discussion of that. And if you're an official and you're aware that the Allies are going to land at some point, that the Germans may well be driven out, and that the public hates you, right? That's a bad combination. Because, right. Like, what are you going to fall back on? You're going to retreat with the Germans? You know, yeah. The most ardent collaborationists actually did that. What are you going to do? So if you're Servier, you start playing both sides. And Jeanine did it in the last episode, and Servier does it in this episode.
Yeah, although I would say, like, to me, what struck me about Servier's move here, which is like, well, instead of the French police arresting the resistance, which I don't want to be the one who's got the resistance blood on my hands, so I'm going to hand him over to the Germans. I guess my thought on that was like, this is going to be a slight distinction without a difference, my friend. Like, I'm not sure this is the big move you think it is. But I think at the time, he's certainly trying to distance himself from anything that is anti-resistance now.
Yeah, but his wife's point is even more sophisticated than that. Her initial point is, why do you want to be involved in this operation at all? You know, the people hate you. You're going to kill a bunch of local boys. Yeah. What's in it? They love Antoine. What do you gain from crushing him? And he's like, we have to, because look, they're going to shoot Chassagne. Maybe I'm next. We actually have to deliver something. And her response is, okay, in that case, turn it over to the Germans, make them do it, so it's not a French operation, and tip off figure out how to get them to escape, so the operation isn't even successful. She's really smart. And that's actually exactly what he does. He pulls back the French forces to give them room to escape. they all escape except four of them, who, you know, end up performing the play for Mueller. Not the greatest end of the season, in my view, but okay. At least if you're going to perform that play over and over again, you should die as a result of it. He forces the Germans to take responsibility for the thing and makes the thing unsuccessful. And of course, thereby gives himself an argument, if it ever comes to that. Hey, I was inside the government, and yeah, I organized some Jewish, deportations and some bad stuff. But when push came to shove, Antoine's alive today because of me. And, you know, that's probably even true.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the other sort of key plot point that's going on as all of this is unfolding. Which is there's really sort of two other tranches of things that are happening. One is the Lucien Berriot Marguerite situation, and the other is our resistance guys in the woods. So let's talk about Marguerite and Lucien and Berriot. So Berriot's back from Lyon, wherever he was, is stunned to find out that Lucien played a key role in this. Basically just says, didn't think you had it in you, but is, you know, proud of her, but is also, you know, now he's running the numbers and he's like, who has to talk? I can see how this goes sideways for us. We probably have to get out of here. Like, there's probably no way that this doesn't eventually find its way back to us. And sort of as he's saying that, basically cops show up, it's French police, which is a slight relief for them. Lucien and Marguerite are being hauled in for questioning. And the broad strokes of this is that he stalls them while they go work on their story. And so when they get called in for questioning, they do well. They like have the same story. They plan to say what they had for lunch, which is the lunch that they had the day before. And Marchetti just can't quite catch them in the lie. But then he does this cop move that I see in lots of shows that is clearly something they must teach you because they see it all the time, which is interviews over, we're exchanging goodbyes and pleasantries. And then at the end, there's sort of like, so this last thing, if you had this salad, that you say you did, of turnips. There's turnip peels in your trash, right? And they basically, for reasons of when trash is emptied, the peels would have been in there had they actually had the lunch that they said they had. And this leads Lucien, who, by the way, holds up quite well under questioning. She then takes a real story and a real sense of shame that she has about kissing Marguerite and turns it into their alibi. They couldn't have been seducing the guard or getting rid of the radio because they were making out. And it's a kind of a funny scene of Marchetti, Trent Lario's like, what are they talking about? I don't understand. Like, what are they saying happened here? And it did occur to me in this scene that for a devout Catholic, like all of the things that Catholics aren't supposed to do, have premarital sex, have an abortion, have a lesbian or same-sex, she's done all of them. She is, whatever. And so she's got a lot of, then she's crying. So she's quite, you know, compelling in the interview. She sells it.
She gets the benefit of all the experiences and all the guilt. It's perfect.
And she unleashes the guilt. And so they're basically let go. But she is in a cell at one point with Marguerite talking about how dirty and bad she feels about all of it. And how she's also weirdly like, I love Berriot, which we all know to not really be the case here. It's more that's where she feels safer in this moment.
Yeah. So this is a super complicated set of interactions, both with the cops and between the two of them, because Lucien clearly was into it and is not prepared to face that. Also, it is the fallback story that's going to get her off of suspicion of having participated in sabotaging the radio. It then does not work because Rainier, the radio operator, blows the whistle on Marguerite that he was the one making out with her, not Lucien. And so she gets the shame of having to play the card of using that story. She also, it is ultimately not successful in the sense that Marguerite still ends up in an interrogation room with Marchetti, knowing full well what the real situation is and being pressured to blow the whistle on Antoine. And of course, she ultimately cannot hide from Berio either that it happened, about which Berio is not especially stoic the way he was about Kurt, either because he's a little bit less tolerant of lesbianism than heterosexual sex, or because he is a little bit less tolerant of marital infidelity than he is of things that happened before he was in the picture. I quite like Berio these days, so I'm going to decide it's more the latter than the former. But, you know, it is a, he is very hurt by it. And so I don't know. I'm more interested in your reactions to it than in my own scattered thoughts about it. But it actually seemed to me like it's, I thought it was a pretty intricate and upsetting set of plot developments, both from the point of view of the pressure that the cops are able to put on people who are actually legit resistance. Marguerite is not a traitor. She's I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name, the industrialist who does business with Schwartz and who
Albert, what is his last name?
It starts with a C, and he has to die for it too. You know, these are people who were legitimately committed.
Crémieux.
Just like they have something super big on Crémieux, like the lives of his wife and daughter. You know, these people have, Marchetti has serious leverage on Marguerite, and it's, don't judge people. I only feel for people who crack under those conditions. And so it's, you know, I thought it was a very upsetting set of scenes.
Yeah, I mean, so here, the thing about Lucien. So Marguerite and Berio both love Lucien. Lucien probably doesn't quite love either of them. But both of them are sort of captive to their feelings about her in these situations. So for Berio, I don't fault him in the slightest for, I don't think that it's like homophobic of him or like that's what's driving it. It is like, at one point he just says to Lucien, like, I have no idea who you are. Like, I don't think I know you at all. And I think that that is a fair reaction to, you know, he already knows that she is certainly fallible. But it's like Marguerite under questioning says this too to Marchetti. She's like, Lucien is stupid. Like she just, you know, like both of them find her charming and whatever. But I think both of them also, this is a limited person that they're dealing with. And like, but it is Marchetti kneeling beside Marguerite saying, let me tell you what they're going to do to Lucien. They're going to rape her in front of her husband. And once they know you're into her too, they'll, you know, in front of you too. And like, he puts these like horrible images in her head. And it is such a complicated and sort of it does crush her soul to watch her flip, because the fact is they just did risk their lives for this mission that she's now diming everybody out for. But it is because of the isolated threat to Lucien in this moment that she doesn't know what to do. And the thing is, Marguerite understands cops. Like at one point she's like, you wouldn't have been in here if you didn't have a deal for me. Like, tell me what the deal is. And so she, just like her Mew, is confronted with, do the thing that helps save the lives of the people who are most important to me in the world, and I'll give up a more abstract thing that's very important to me, but I'll give it up because I love these people too much. And I think that is, it's human. I don't know what to do about that. So what is to me the most devastating part of this, and so in these scenes, which is sort of incredible, it's my favorite part of these episodes besides the Chesani and Marcel cell scenes, is that you're watching all three of them try to make really fast decisions, right? They've got to flee. They don't know who each other are. The trust is really broken. So at some point, you know, we find out that one of the cops who also is working on the inside, we've seen him now in a lot of scenes. I think he's the one who forged the letter, but he basically comes to see Berio. He's like, I'm with the resistance. She flipped on you guys. She sold you all out. And everybody knows, we know, we just saw Janine do it. Everybody knows that when somebody has infiltrated the resistance or is a threat to them or is putting their lives at risk, they gotta go. And so Marguerite has just signed a death sentence. And so Berio gets his gun. And so not only now has she admitted to, because she says it at some point to him, maybe she says it while he's got the gun pointed at her, that she also loves Lucienne and like knows what it's like to have her in her arms or something like that. But at the end of the day, Berio cannot shoot Marguerite at point blank range. He just can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, he protects, she betrayed the encampment in order to protect, among other people, him and his wife. And that's a crime that the resistance can't forgive, and probably rightly so.
Yep.
But it is a crime that he personally can't punish her for. And that strikes me as wonderfully human. I do think, and again, I think Berio is this character who starts out as a kind of clownish figure, and a figure of some contempt of, and grows and grows and grows on you. And I think his handling of this whole season, but this episode in particular, he has exactly the right mix of emotions and responses. He becomes very Marie-like in basically just quickly doing the right thing. I do want to say that like Marcel in the cell, I have had during this recording an insect visitor. Not a cockroach, a grasshopper. And you may have heard this grasshopper chirping earlier in the episode. I want to say that unlike Marcel, I did not build a home for it and defend it. I just vacuumed it up while Sarah was speaking with dispatch and Mueller-like efficiency. And so there will be no more chirping on this episode.
That noise that was coming from that cricket noise, you're telling me that was one cricket? I thought you were surrounded by thousands listening to that.
So, well, I thought there were some like confused cicadas outside, but while you were speaking, my eye lit on a single cricket inside the confines of my little recording studio room here. And you saw me. I reached over with a little handheld vacuum cleaner and looked him up. Did not hold a trial for him, by the way. Didn't get him a defense attorney.
No justice in the widow's house.
There is. I mean, he was simply summarily executed. And now the terrorism of the crickets has been alleviated.
Yeah. So I just want to, wrap up this, the Lucienne, Marguerite storyline, because what happens, and it's interesting, I don't know if you have an opinion on it, but like I said, they're all trying to think fast. So they're all making these kind of strange not strange decisions, but like Barrio's got to decide whether to kill Marguerite. Marguerite's got to decide whether, you know, they're all leaving together. And, you know, is sort of taking Barrio's word for it that he's going to get her out of there until she realizes that's not happening. And then basically is just like, she's just like, just shoot me, like do it. But he can't do it. However, at one point, Barrio sees the French cop, the French resistance guy, it's Vernet. We see him on the way out coming to the school, and he says, they're coming to kill Marguerite, and tells Lucienne, I'm going to distract him. I'm going to hold him off. Go warn her that they're coming to kill her. And Lucienne begins to run to where Marguerite is. And instead of going down to warn her, she hears these two girls, and we've seen the two girls before, fighting over the doll. She sees them fighting over the doll, and she runs out to them instead and stand there and sort of lectures them about responsibility and consequences until we hear the gun go off. And we know that Marguerite has been killed. And we know that Lucienne just decided in that split second to not warn her, to let it happen. As high a note as it was the last two episodes where Lucienne does something heroic, I gotta say, to me, this is the lowest moment for Lucienne, because what Barrio's, you know, despite the fact that we understand that Marguerite is now a threat to the resistance and she's done something unforgivable and there's, you know, there's consequences for that. On the flip side, everything Marguerite did was to protect Lucienne. And I think this is a good example of Lucienne being too cowardly, too small to know how to make the bigger, better decision, which is the one Barrio arrives at, which is, she did this for us. Like, at minimum, we've got to get her out of here. And he does that knowing that this weird thing has happened between his wife and Marguerite that he doesn't completely understand. Lucienne, on the other hand, Marguerite did the whole thing because of her. And Lucienne just doesn't walk down the next flight of stairs. She just abdicates the decision of saving Marguerite's life and lets her die.
Yeah, it's a really low moment for her. But Lucienne is pretty consistently reckless with other people's lives. We learn that about her in the very first episode. And Lucienne values her own safety above just about everything else. And she occasionally breaks through it, but there is a reversion to the mean that's pretty consistent with her. And this is a particularly horrible example of it. And the show puts a real asterisk or a pin, you know, a real foot stomp on this point by the dispute that she goes out to resolve is a dispute that we have previously seen Marguerite defending the actual owner of the doll against this larger predatory girl who steals the doll from her. And, you know, so rather than go warn Marguerite and get her running, she goes and sort of channels her her dispute resolution issues to these two girls while in fact somebody goes and kills her. And of course it's super convenient to Lucienne, because with Marguerite dies the shame that she feels about the lesbian encounter. I suppose it's possible for her to, you know, when Barrio says to her, sometimes I don't know who you are. And she says, I'm your wife. It allows that self-delusion to, you know, persist and propagate. And so it's, you know, Marguerite is very, her existence is very stressful for Lucienne. And, you know, if she just does her job for a minute and make sure the right girl gets her doll back, all of these problems just go away. And, you know, they go away because some other mean person comes and doesn't understand the situation. And that's where, that's Lucienne's comfort spot, you know, when she can be passive and problems just go away on their own. And, you know, it's what one of our listeners calls her goldfish energy. But this is, you know, goldfish energy, getting somebody, and somebody who loves her killed.
Yeah. And was protecting her. Not real happy with Lucienne in this particular moment. So the last thing really is our boys in the woods.
Thank God, so, at least the play is over now.
I thought about you as I watched it, and it was funny because the first time I watched it, I couldn't help but be influenced this time by you, because the first time I watched it, I was like quite moved by the ending picture of Claude and gagging motion from Ben. I love Terry. I never liked Claude that much, but I sort of liked this idea of these boys trying to occupy themselves with this story that like surrounded them. And I also think this is something that's like notoriously hard for television shows to do, which is like, whether it's a show about comedy and they're trying to like show you the comedy's never funny. Or if they're trying, like, you know, the show that comes to mind is that Sunset. It's like, that was, I don't know. It was an old, by the guy who did The West Wing. It's supposed to be like an SNL type sketch comedy show. And they would, you know, occasionally show you the sketch comedy, which is the whole reason that they're all there together. And it was never funny. Anyway, so the point is that the play is not good. We only get very small snippets of it. But it was something that mattered to all of them, that bound them together there in the woods, that was allowing this kind of transformation of all of them, from whether it's boys to men, not the singing group, but the actual transformation, the whether it's, people who are trying to get out of forced labor, to people who are actively, you know, part of the resistance and leading the resistance, meaningful warriors in some sense. So anyway, I didn't hate it as much as you did, although when I watched it this time, it lost a lot of its romance for me, because all I could hear was you being like, this sucks. but I will say, you know, it's interesting, or it's a good scene, like where they're all climbing the rock, it's raining, and Anselm, who's got to be like in his mid-50s, scales the rocks. Antoine does it after him. It's 160 feet, they tell us. I sort of don't understand why they have to do this, because now the Servier's got the French back by miles. And so it didn't seem to me like maybe this was exactly necessary, but whatever. They're climbing the rocks and then they're sort of pulling people up one by one. And Claude and Terry and a couple of the other guys are going last because they're kind of scared to climb these rocks. But at some point, the German soldiers show up and those four are still down there. And, you know, Antoine wants to go and save them. But Anselm says to him, look, kid, you're a good leader. The resistance needs you. There's nothing we can do for them. And so they leave them there and the rope kind of comes down and the four of them go back to their camp. And Claude seems to know. He's sort of like, give me the wine. And they start to perform the play and basically wait for the Germans to come. Now, whether they know they're done for is a little bit, you can't quite tell, but it seems like Claude at least knows. And at the end, the Germans get them.
Yeah. I think this is, you know, look, Anselm is right. You can get almost everybody away. The Germans are literally within, you know, a stone's throw of where they are. They can slip away and, or you can get everybody killed trying to get the last four people up the cliff. It's one of those heartbreaking situations that's mitigated only by the fact that at least we won't have to deal with this play in season five. And, you know, I think from a resistance point of view, the operation is a success. Marguerite betrays their location and they get everybody but four people out. You know, that's pretty good. The Germans, you know, Servier is Servier's information is actually helpful. He gets them a path out without ever communicating any information. I mean, it's all good, except that they do lose four people, and they're two of whom are people we've grown attached to, or at least you've grown attached to. And it's a super painful decision for Antoine, but, you know, he actually listens to Anselm, who's quite correct, and they get almost everybody out of there. And, you know, I think you are left with this sense, oh shit, some of our boys that we care about have gotten killed. But, you know, from a larger military picture, they protected the unit. That's no small thing.
Yeah. I was sad the first time that I saw this. I knew it was coming this time, but I remember being quite moved. Body count's kind of high, end of the fourth season, just like that. And it was interesting, you know, the third season ended the same way, actually, with the resistance surrounded and some escaping and some not.
First season ended that way, too, with the shootout at the farmhouse and the secret tunnel and, you know, Dick Kavern and Marie killing the husband. A lot of, you know, bad, narrow escape moments for the resistance people at the end of seasons.
Yeah, but we do lose a lot of like ancillary resistance characters along the way. And in this case, you know, we lose Marguerite. We lose our four guys in the woods. We lose Marcel. And we lose Chisanya, which no one's going to cry for him. And putting them together for an execution is sort of an interesting thing because there's a weird way that you feel about the execution, which is good riddance, Chisanya. I'm glad Mueller got you. And, you know, sadness about Marcel, but also a kind of like, this is probably the right choice for the show to make, because otherwise it starts to strain credulity. And also, I'll just say that this slight flashback we've been getting the whole time, we see sort of completed in the moments of Marcel's death, where he remembers this time that Daniel took a beating for him, that he was doing something
for stealing toy soldiers.
Exactly, for stealing some of his dad's like miniature figurines or something. And it is nice. It's something that the last thoughts on his mind was that his brother was a positive memory of how his brother protected him.
And that his brother follows that up by following Suzanne's guidance that he should not be buried in the family plot, which would require a religious funeral, but should be buried, because Suzanne does not know about his waving away the priest, but intuits it and wants him buried in the woods. And Danielle accedes to that, though it's clearly important to him at some level that he be buried in the family plot.
Yeah, he does what he knows. Suzanne knows better what Marcel would have wanted, and he does what Marcel would have wanted. And so there is in this some long awaited reconciliation of the brothers, even though in the cell, it's still their kind of feud continued, but with a kind of affection. And anyway, I think that the resolution between them is still complicated, but still satisfying.
Yes, I agree. So key question before we wrap up, is the Bulwark going to renew us for season 5?
I think we can dispense with the theater and just say we're going to be back. So I will tell you, just to, in case you're planning your calendar for the number of episodes. So season 5, we've turned a corner here. Season 5 is 12 episodes, but season 6 and 7 are 6 episodes piece. And so that leaves us with 24 episodes, about 3 months worth of episodes. And so, you know, we'll be done before Christmas. But
I'm excited about it. We will be back next week with season 5.
Season 5.
And until then, Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. Homme t'aime tous les amants. Et puis...